Next case is People in the Interest of Minor Children versus CM and others. Both parties ready?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Case is set for half hour. Each of you, please keep track of your time and please state your name at the beginning of your argument. You may proceed.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Phil Nalop. I'm the attorney for the Department of Human Services. My registration number is 9076. I'll be sharing some of my time with the guardian ad litem, Kim Bierhoff, who will be presenting some of the, we're trying to divide up the arguments to some extent to try to clarify what we consider to be an overextension of the Court of Appeals authority. The facts in this case, we believe, are very important, and it is fact-specific. There are lots of players, and the relationship is somewhat confusing, but there's five children involved. One passed away, tragically, and under very horrific circumstances. Termination of parental rights occurred as to the other four. Now, the mother, respondent, appeals her termination rights as to those four children. She was a stepmother to the decedent child. Facts are extremely horrific, but for the most part, the underlying facts of what brought the dependency neglect action in the first place and what constituted the acts of omission and commission on the part of the mother were uncontroverted at trial. The trial was relatively simple. It consisted of an expert witness by the department on a psychological evaluation done on the mother. It consisted of testimony with regard to the treatment plan and compliance of the treatment plan by representatives of the Department of Human Services and some other witnesses. The rub here and what you have asked us to discuss today on certiorari, and we appreciate the opportunity, is whether the relationship of the division clerk to one of the witnesses in the case, and that relationship being mother-daughter relationship, was enough to constitute so great of an appearance of impropriety that the trial judge should have disqualified himself as a matter of law from the case.
And then this is brought after the proceeding, right? To avoid it, basically.
And it's interesting that the trial judge, there are two cases in front of the trial judge. The criminal case is proceeding, and at the same time, the dependency neglect case is proceeding. The criminal case concluded. The judge entered sentence, incidentally, giving the mother the minimum sentence under the range based upon her felony conviction for felony three. And then the termination case commenced after that, and all the hearings with regard to the factual matters of termination occurred after the sentencing. That all was completed, and then only after that, and while the parties were waiting for a decision from the judge, did the motion for new trial, the motion for ineffectiveness of counsel, or new trial based on ineffectiveness of counsel, and the motion for disqualification occurred at that point. And we think that it's significant that this was a trial strategy as opposed to a matter of substance. Fact-wise, it's real, very clear.
But why do you say that? Because it was known? I mean, the relationship was known?
Well known. Well known to the attorney. Well known throughout the course of
Mr. Malik, you only have a couple of minutes, and let's assume you're right about trial strategy. We still have the legal issue, which I think is an important one, and I guess I'd ask you to address it.
Thank you. Well, this body has pronounced standards of review, abuse of discretion in civil cases, has indicated through your pronouncements that there are levels, things that need to be evaluated, relationships of the parties. That we believe to be the rules of the game when this case was considered by the trial judge. The trial judge took a look at what he had in front of him, which was a singular affidavit. Singular affidavit asserted no facts other than a blood relationship and then submitted to the judge for his determination. Now, if the judge uses your rules and applies them and the standard that you have set, you as the Supreme Court, then he was correct in denying the motion and proceeding on with a resolution of the case. But what the Court of Appeals did was say, wait a minute, not only, and we agreed to some extent that the judge's ruling was deficient with regard to the findings of fact. But what the Court of Appeals said was, we not only remand for that, we remand because we're changing the standard. We're changing it to an appearance of impropriety. We're changing it because of a relationship that exists, not necessarily with the trier of fact, but with a court personnel type. And we're going to use a standard that's espoused by the federal system to try to assist with regard to developing this appearance of impropriety. Now, your pronouncements indicate that there are relationships that need to be evaluated. The judge to his clerk and the clerk to the witness. The trial judge in this case was given only information to suggest that one of those relationships might be tainted. Yet, if we look at the pronouncements both statutorily and with this court, the tainting has to do with whether there is a family interest, and by that I mean some, I believe the interpretation is not family as such, but family, the family is going to benefit somehow, or a financial interest, or a professional interest. Now, there was no assertions of any of that as to that relationship, and there was no assertions with regard to the judge as to his clerk. So the trial court is left to surmise, and only the trial court would know whether he has relied upon issue or information from the division clerk to help him formulate his decision. Now, the rub for the department is that in small communities, we have to deal with conflicts of interest all the time. We have to deal with disqualifications and recusals, and it's in a very finite population, things just happen. We only have one Safeway. We only have one Walmart. We don't have a Taco Bell.
This is a little hunter that you're referring to?
Yes, sir, but in the whole judicial district. Yeah. I mean, there's limited school systems. There's overlap all the time. Attorneys get appointed to the bench.
Oh, so we have a special rule for rural districts?
No,
than urban ones?
But this court should espouse a rule, sir, that is applicable in both areas that doesn't serve to prejudice either, so that all parties have a fair access to the judicial system. And that's where I think the Court of Appeals exceeds its authority. If we accept their appearance of impropriety standard, they've usurped your powers. They declare that by their decree, there is going to be a new rule of participation, and it completely ignores the administration of justice on the local level. You're already asking your trial judges to make decisions with voir dire, make decisions with regard to qualifications of jurors and participants in cases, and it's a common occurrence in smaller judicial districts for the trial judges to deal with that on an everyday basis. All of a sudden, take that away without any showing factually to support that there was anything imprudent here or inappropriate. It is, I believe, a total abrogation of this court's rulings previously. Now, the standard that the Court of Appeals suggests is a federal standard, and we can go back into the history of why federal courts were created to eliminate bias and prejudice and local concern and so forth and so on. But that standard is really an opposite to what goes on the local level. And on the local level, we have to give the judges enough authority to be able to take a look at and sense whether there is a problem, both in terms of their participation and in others that participate in the judicial system. Court of Appeals, without any basis factually, says let's change the rules. And now, because this clerk is related to a witness, that taints this judge's ability to make fair and impartial decisions in the case based on no assertion of facts. That works a great hardship on the local level. And there we have in the 10th Judicial District, I know of a district attorney married to a division clerk. In the 15th Judicial District, we have a brother practicing in front of a county judge. In the 16th Judicial District, we only have one court reporter. She is engaged to one of the public defenders. How far do we go in allowing in a small populated circumstance to have interlocking relationships without declaring that every relationship is a conflict? Interestingly enough, the attorney for the respondent mother at the trial level was a partner and practicing with the trial judge. They had a relationship as deputy district attorneys for years. So that was not disclosed on the record. That was not suggested by the respondent mother as a basis for bias or prejudice in this case. It was only after the fact, when I believe that it was more clear that the case was going to be decided on behalf of the department, that this need for a resolution of this recusal came about. As a matter of local practice, as a matter of law, we assert that the standard of practice that you have asserted is appropriate. It leaves the discretion with the appropriate people that can make the calls based upon the facts. If you can't trust your trial judges to make those appropriate calls,
but is there anything amounting to a due process violation? I'm just thinking of that West Virginia case, the U.S. Supreme Court. At some point, this conflict of interest of a judge, obviously, can end up voiding a decision. It's an unusual result to void a decision, right, or set it aside. So would you explore that a little bit?
Yes, sir. I think the due process requires, certainly in a termination process, is that there be effective counsel. Counsel be appointed and given an opportunity to access the courts. I don't think that due process requires that every possible contingency of question needs to be resolved. It says that there are certain minimum standards, certain basic standards, and I think that those matters are met in the instant case. It does not say that, especially in a small town, that there isn't going to be somebody that shops at the same grocery store or has a kid that goes to the same Boy Scout troop or goes to the same school, which we deal with on a daily basis. Your Honor, I think that the Court of Appeals got it right when they said it should be remanded with instructions to make more specific findings. If that was their sole decision, we wouldn't be here today. I think they were overreaching by saying we're going to change the standard that this body has created, making a new standard of which the trial judge had simply no notice. Thank you.
May it please the court? Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Kim Verhoff, and I'm the guardian ad litem for the minor children that are involved in this case. And I just want to raise a few more issues beyond what Mr. Maloff has stated. I believe that the court has promulgated rules that are very specific in regards to employees, and they do that pursuant to statute. And I believe where the appellate court might have got it wrong is the fact that it does not state anything about a material witness. That's where the federal statute and the state statutes, or the state rules, excuse me, disagree. The states are very clear that it is just the conflicts that Mr. Maloff stated, the family, the employment, and any business or personal relationship. Ms. Camacho, the daughter of the clerk, was just an employee of the Department of Social Services. And that's how she presented at the court, and that's how she was at the court. That was her role within the court. There was no showing whatsoever that any of the things that this court has decided applied in that matter. The federal statute even goes on to say that there may be an undue hardship exception to their material witness argument. So, again, it would be nice if the clerk had knowledge that this was a problem. But, you know, the clerk was even put in a bad situation here because she had no knowledge that this was going to be the standard. The judge had no knowledge this was going to be the standard. And honestly, if someone thinks on this panel thinks it needs to be changed, it can be done, but through the rules. We can't hold this judge.
Could you, Ms. Vaughn, you're repeating the argument essentially that the prior to the Court of Appeals opinion, the rules, which is I think what the argument Mr. Maloff was making, were somehow very limited and very narrow and could not possibly involve this sort of relationship. Could you just point me to what it is that you're talking about in terms of what is so restrictive that we are not just talking about whether this is a reasonable appearance, we are instead saying the rule precludes it?
Well, I wouldn't say it precludes it, Your Honor. I would say that it has very specific meaning. I have read the rule, and I could read the rule. It says, an employee shall avoid any involvement in the processing of any matter before the courts or probation in which the employee has a personal, business, or family interest and immediately inform the administrative authority to the existence of such conflict of interest. That's the rule as stated within the state of Colorado.
That's a rule with regard to an employee's conduct, right?
That is correct, and that's what the
and that certainly might inform our decision here, but aren't we a little bit more concerned with the judicial code of conduct?
I would agree with you, Your Honor, and I believe the judicial code of conduct is limited as well. It states specifically a judge shall recuse himself if there isn't a relationship to the third degree. That's his family. That doesn't state anything about an employee's family at all. There is nothing in there that states that. I think that rule is very specific and it's very clear. And I think the judge was relying on that when he made this decision, to be perfectly honest. Well, in conclusions, Your Honor, on behalf of the children, I would just ask that we get, no matter what the decision, a quick decision. These children have been in the system for 3 years, 7 months, and 8 days. That's an awful long time for children to be waiting. And if at all possible,
Huff, can I ask you a question that Mr. Maloff mentioned at the very end? You're asking us to reverse and remand for findings, or just reverse?
Just reverse in regards to the conflict. Thank you.
May it please the court. I'm David Miyacho, representing the mother, CM, in this case. My registration number is 8404. I'd like to start by just addressing a couple of things. The guardian ad litem indicated that the children are waiting. They're not waiting. They're in the custody of natural parents. They're in the custody of their fathers, which is where they will reside. And so the children are not waiting for a disposition of some sort here. The children are in the custody of their fathers, where probably at this point they should be. There are three things I'd like to talk about today. The first thing is the context in which all this occurs. The second thing is the principles of law, and the third is the appearance of impropriety. The personal considerations, due process was raised. There's an umbrella of due process over this case, so it's not a garden variety civil litigation matter. Mother is due fundamental fairness. And that's something that has to be considered when we consider what the standard is going to be for recusal. We have to remember that in that context, the odds were already heavily against mother in this case. She was in the courtroom, represented by her court-appointed attorney, on the other side, DHS, the caseworker, the expert witness, and so on and so forth. Also part of the context is DHS's insistence that somehow, because this is a small jurisdiction, that there are some exceptions that apply, that all of a sudden a more liberal standard as to recusal should be adopted by this court. And of course, there is the fact that the judge had already heard mother's criminal case and had already sentenced mother. Contrary to what DHS says in this case, the principles of law are well established. And the Court of Appeals relied on well-established principles of law. It's been, I was reminded as I looked at this case, that it's been over 40 years since I left law school. And that's depressing enough. But it is true, as a friend of mine says, that the legs are not the first thing to go. So there's much that I learned in law school that I do not remember. But I remember very well the first time I heard the standard that the Court of Appeals applied in this case just recently, which is that a judge must avoid even the appearance of impropriety. My eyes were open. All of a sudden, I said, that's a wonderful thing. That's something I didn't know. I knew about regular conflicts of interest, that actual conflicts of interest, which is what Mr. Maloff is.
That's fine and all, but isn't the situation have to be brought to the judge's attention basically before some judgment is entered that can affect the rights and duties and responsibilities, and here the care of children and the termination of mother's rights based on egregious circumstances?
I mean,
are you seeking to avoid the judgment? Based on this appearance of impropriety?
Yes. Yes.
Right. Isn't a different standard applicable to that?
You mean to the appearance of impropriety?
To the protection of judgments, based on the allegation post, you know, judgment of the appearance of impropriety. That's an extreme remedy, is it not? So what do you have to support that?
Well, that raises a separate issue of whether, the question is whether the judge should have recused himself. I would argue...
On his own, without any motion or affidavit...
Sua sponte.
Sua sponte.
Yes.
Recognizing that he can't proceed.
I think so. At the very least.
That seems to me a startling result, does it? Doesn't that seem curious, that you can void a judgment based on an appearance of impropriety, not an actual impropriity, based on the allegation after the judgment is entered?
Let me modify my answer to your question. I don't know that for sure we're seeking to void the judgment, because what we don't know, there's a lot that isn't in the record. For example, there's nothing in the record to support Mr. Maloff's contentions about what goes on in small jurisdictions. Just so they're in the record to indicate, for example, we're talking here about whether Mother actually waived the conflict of interest. Let's assume for the sake of argument there's a conflict of interest. Did Mother waive it? That requires a voluntary relinquishment of a known right, particularly in a due process context. And so what's not in the record is whether Mother was advised by counsel, hey, there's a conflict of interest here, whether Mother knew about the relationship between the caseworker and the court's clerk, whether Mother understood the relationship between the court's clerk and the trial court. All these things are not matters of record. So I think the Court of Appeals actually made an appropriate disposition of this case. They didn't send it back and say, it's reversed, it's all undone, I'm doing this judgment. They did not say that. Court of Appeals said, we're sending it back. We need to first explore.
In that sense, didn't they sort of put the cart before the horse? That is, they addressed the conflict issue, but then send it back to see whether it really needs to be addressed or not, based on this notion that the failure to timely raise it might be excused if there was attorney ineffective assistance.
Well, that's the interplay between ineffective assistance of counsel and the question of the appearance of impropriety here. So it's not, I mean, it's a unique case. The Court of Appeals appropriately observed it's a case of first impression. I don't believe they got the cart before the horse, because they addressed an important issue here, which is the question of, is it appropriate for a judge to be passing...
But is it necessary at all to address that issue in the event that there was not ineffective assistance of counsel?
I think so, because I think this is a significant enough conflict of interest that the judge, aware of the situation, should have at least advised Mother. I don't know whether he was required to recuse himself sua sponte.
I thought it was represented in the argument of Mr. Maloff, and I thought also in the briefs that Mother was advised. Is that incorrect?
There is nothing in the record to indicate that Mother was ever advised of the situation. Nothing in the record.
My recollection is that what was stated was that was done in the criminal case. Is that correct? And is it just not in the, I mean, is it not in the record? Or?
I know of no place in the record where that would be supported, where the notion that Mother was in fact advised of this exists. I look for it in the record.
And what about counsel?
The counsel knew about it?
Yes.
Counsel admitted that he knew about it when he confessed ineffectiveness.
Okay.
Yes, counsel said he knew about it, but he never said, I appropriately advised my client of what the ramifications of it were. So that's the best I can do, is to say that there's nothing in the record to support the notion that Mother knew about it, or was appropriately advised of it.
Well, when this case goes back, if it does, according to the Court of Appeals order, I mean, if we just agreed with them, when it goes back and the trial court determines if there's ineffective assistance of counsel, what would it have to decide in order to decide that that there was ineffective assistance, and that wouldn't it have to make some decision that there was some prejudicial effect?
I think so. And I think that focuses the question of why the Court of Appeals chose to decide the ethical question as well, the recusal.
Well, if the conflict is merely an appearance issue as opposed to an actual conflict, that is, the judge is not conflicted, but merely concerned about the bad appearances, What would be the prejudice?
That gets me to the nub. I'll just skip the other things that I talked about and say it is well established. And I think we talked about the Code of Judicial Conduct. The Code of Judicial Conduct says that a judge should disqualify himself in a proceeding in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. And then it goes on to say, including but not limited to da 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 da, but in which his impartiality might reasonably be questioned. So the standard, there's nothing novel about that standard. That codifies the standard that a judge must avoid even the appearance of impropriety.
So that certainly makes sense when the issue is timely raised and the judge rules on the issue before proceeding with the case. But does that make sense when you're seeing it in retrospect through the lens of ineffective assistance of counsel?
I think so. Because what we don't know is what counsel told his client. That's the problem. It's not counsel's decision to make when you're talking about a waiver of something like this. It is the client's decision to make in the context of an informed decision. And so
raises one final question I have in this area, and that is, I know the Court of Appeals talked about waiver and you have adopted that, but is that really the right concept here? Aren't we talking about a forfeiture because it's a failure to raise a claim as opposed to a waiver, which would require some advice? And
I think we're talking about waiver. An appearance of impropriety, assuming that we have this sort of a conflict, can be waived? Yeah, of course it can. Sure. I think that mother could easily agree to say, yes, under these circumstances.
Or isn't that inconsistent with your earlier argument that this was a mandatory disqualification by the judge?
Well, no. I think it is. But if the judge declares a conflict of interest and mother says, that's okay, I want to go ahead and have it heard, then I believe it could be waived. I believe the law is that it can be waived. But in this case, the facts of this case require the examination of two relationships, the relationship between mother and daughter, well, we don't have to go too deeply into that one, and the relationship between the judge and his clerk. This is different from the Shepherd case, which Justice Ide wrote that you have to examine the closeness of the relationship and its impact on the case.
Can I stop you there? Why? I mean, I'm struggling a little bit here with understanding how the nature of this relationship reflects on the judge somehow being unable to be impartial with respect to this testimony. As I understood it, the caseworker testified, but there was also expert testimony. Was any of that testimony disputed in this hearing, such that the trial judge would have to exercise credibility determinations and it might call that into play?
Well, certainly I think mother was disputing it, at least by a cross-examination of the caseworker. But the problem is the caseworker is the linchpin of the case, because the caseworker testifies, yes, the treatment plan was adopted, and yes, mother either failed to comply with it or failed to rehabilitate mother.
Was there any testimony that she had in fact complied?
Mother testified to it, yes. So, yes, there were credibility determinations to make. And the credibility of the witness is always at issue. And so what happens, that raises an interesting point. What happens if the judge decides that he doesn't believe the caseworker, that he doesn't believe the caseworker on the issue of whether DHS used reasonable efforts or whether mother complied with the treatment plan? The judge is now in the uncomfortable position of having to kind of explain to his clerk, look, I didn't believe your daughter. And so that's why I didn't uphold the termination, because I didn't believe the DHS caseworker. That's the nature of an appearance of impropriety, is that we're not talking about the appearance of impropriety with respect to the Supreme Court or even to me, or to anybody inside the system. We're talking about the appearance of impropriety to the public. It is a policy question. How does it appear to members of the public? What would a member of the public say if confronted with this fact situation, that the judge's head clerk is sitting at the judge's right hand and the judge is passing on the credibility of the caseworker who's the daughter of the head clerk? That's the question. So when the public sees that, is the public going to say, oh, there's something wrong here? Something needs to change.
So why wouldn't the more flexible standard announced in the Shepherd case that you just mentioned not apply?
Well, the standard applies, that you have to look at the closeness of the relationships, that is to say the closeness of the relationship between judge and clerk and mother and daughter, and the impact on the case. In this case, you have the judge passing directly on the credibility of the daughter of his clerk. That's what you have. The question is, does that pass the test of appearance of impropriety? I'd like to return just briefly to the appearance of impropriety, because I think that that's got to be the focus here. I don't want it to be less than clear that the appearance of impropriety is just as important and just as much to be avoided as actual impropriety. DHS has said, well, there's been no evidence of actual impropriety. I submit that that is irrelevant. If there is an appearance of impropriety, then there must be recusal. And the reason...
What standard of judicial conduct says what you just said?
Well, the Code of Judicial Conduct says in which judge should remove himself from any case in which his impartiality might reasonably...
But it has a process where there's affidavits and it's tested and the judge can decide whether to recuse or not. And that decision is left to the individual judge, is it not?
It is.
Okay.
Yes, it is. It's left to the individual judge, but it's not completely up to the individual judge. There's this great language in the Johnson case that I'd just like to close with. And it says, moreover, not only the actuality of fairness must concern us, but the appearance of fairness as well. Courts must meticulously avoid any appearance of partiality, not merely to secure the confidence of litigants, but to retain public respect and secure willing and ready obedience to their judgments. Thank you.
I'm Zoltan Stolak. Case will stand submitted, and the court will take up our next case.